The Riverlands are full of maids you've pleased, all drinking tansy tea. You'd think a man as old as you would know to spill his seed on their bellies. Men will be calling you Tom Seven Sons before much longer. As it happens, said Tom, I passed seven many years ago, and fine boys they are, too, with voices sweet as nightingales. Plainly he did not care for the subject.
"Did his lordship say where they were bound, milady?" asked Harwin.
"Lord Berwick never shares his plans, but there's hunger down near Stony Sept and the Threepenny Wood. I should look for him there." She took a sip of wine. "You'd best know, I've had less pleasant callers as well. A pack of wolves came howling around my gates, thinking I might have Jamie Lannister in here." Tom stopped his plucking. "Then it's true. The Kingslayer is loose again." Lady Smallwood gave him a scornful look. "I hardly think they'd be hunting him if he was chained up on the River Rotten." "What did my lady tell them?" asked Jack Belucky. "Why, that I had Sir Jamie naked in my bed, but I'd left him much too exhausted to come down. One of them had the effrontery to call me a liar. So we saw them off with a few quarrels. I believe they made for Black Bottom Bend."
Arya squirmed restlessly in her seat.
"What Northman was it who came looking after the Kingslayer?" Lady Smallwood seemed surprised that she'd spoken. "They did not give their names, child, but they wore black, with a badge of a white sun on the breast."
A white sun on black was the sigil of Lord Carstark, Arya thought. Those were Rubb's men. She wondered if they were still close. If she could give the outlaws a slip and find them, maybe they would take her to her mother at Riverrun.
"Did they say a Lannister came to escape?" Lem asked. "They did," said Lady Smallwood. "Not that I believe a word of it. They claimed that Lady Catelyn set him free."
That startled Tom so badly he snapped a string.
"Go on with you," he said. "That's madness."
"It's not true," thought Arya. "It couldn't be true."
"I thought the same," said Lady Smallwood.
That was when Harwin remembered Arya. "Such talk is not for your ears, milady."
"No, I want to hear."
The outlaws were adamant.
"Go on with you, skinny squirrel," said Greenbeard. "Be a good little lady, and go play in the yard while we talk now."
Arya stalked away angry, and would have slammed the door if it hadn't been so heavy. Darkness had settled over Acorn Hall. A few torches burned along the walls, but that was all. The gates of the little castle were closed and barred. She had promised Harwin that she would not try and run away again, she knew. But that was before they started telling lies about her mother.
"Arya?"
Gendry had followed her out.
"Lady Smallwood said there's a smithy. Want to have a look?"
"If you want." She had nothing else to do.
"This Thoros," Gendry said as they walked past the kennels. "Is he the same Thoros who lived in the castle at King's Landing? A red priest, fat, with a shaved head?"
"I think so." Arya had never spoken to Thoros at King's Landing that she could recall, but she knew who he was. He and Jalabar Zo had been the most colourful figures at Robert's court, and Thoros was a great friend of the king as well.
"He won't remember me, but he used to come to our forge."
The Smallwood forge had not been used in some time, though the smith had hung his tools neatly on the wall. Gendry lit a candle and set it on the anvil while he took down a pair of tongs.
"My master always scolded him about his flaming swords. It was no way to treat good steel, he'd say, but this Thoros never used good steel. He just dipped some cheap sword in wildfire and set it alight. It was only an alchemist trick, my master said, but it scared the horses and some of the greener knights."
She screwed up her face, trying to remember if her father had ever talked about Thoros.
"He isn't very priestly, is he?"
"No," Gentry admitted.
"Master Mott said Thoros could outdrink even King Robert. They were peas in a pod, he told me. "Both gluttons and sots. You shouldn't call the king a sot. Maybe King Robert had drunk a lot, but he'd been her father's friend. I was talking about Thoris." Gendry reached out with the tongs as if to pinch her face, but Arya swatted them away. "He liked feasts and tourneys. That was why King Robert was so fond of him. And this Thoris was brave. When the walls of Pike crashed down, he was the first through the breach. He fought with one of his flaming swords, setting Iron Men afire with every slash." "I wish I had a flaming sword." Arya could think of a lot of people she'd like to set on fire. "It's only a trick, I told you. The wildfire ruins the steel. My master sold Thoris a new sword after every tourney. Every time they would have a fight about the price." Gendry hung the tongs back up and took down the heavy hammer. "Master Mott said it was time I made my first longsword. He gave me a sweet piece of steel, and I knew just how I wanted to shape the blade. Only Yoren came and took me away for the night's watch."
"You can still make swords if you want," said Arya. "You can make them for my brother Rob when we get to River Run."
"River Run?" Gendry put the hammer down and looked at her. "You look different now, like a proper girl."
"I look like an oak tree with all these stupid acorns."
"Nice, though, a nice oak tree."
He stepped closer and sniffed at her.
"You even smell nice for a change."
"You don't. You stink." Arya shoved him back against the anvil and made to run, but Gendry caught her arm. She stuck a foot between his legs and tripped him, but he yanked her down with him, and they rolled across the floor of the smithy. He was very strong, but she was quicker. Every time he tried to hold her still, she wriggled free and punched him. Gendry only laughed at the blows, which made her mad. He finally caught both her wrists in one hand and started to tickle her with the other, so Arya slammed her knee between his legs and wrenched free. Both of them were covered in dirt, and one sleeve was torn on her stupid acorn dress. "I bet I don't look so nice now," she shouted. Tom was singing when they returned to the hall. "My feather bed is deep and soft, and there I'll lay you down. I'll dress you all in yellow silk, and on your head a crown. For you shall be my lady love, and I shall be your lord. And I'll always keep you safe and warm, and guard you with my sword." Harwin took one look at them and burst out laughing. And Angai smiled one of his stupid, freckly smiles and said,
"Are we certain this one is a high-born lady?"
But Lem Lemoncloak gave Gendry a clout alongside the head.
"You want to fight? Fight with me. She's a girl, and half your age. You keep your hands off of her. You hear me?"
"I started it," said Arya. "Gendry was just talking."
"Leave the boy, Lem," said Harwin. "Arya did start it, I have no doubt. She was much the same at Winterfell."
Tom winked at her as he sang.
"And how she smiled, and how she laughed, the maiden of the tree. She spun away and said to him, 'No feather bed for me. I'll wear a gown of golden leaves and bind my hair with grass. But you can be my forest love, and me your forest lass.'"
"I have no gowns of leaves," said Lady Smallwood, with a small, fond smile. "But Carillon left some other dresses that might serve. Come, child, let's go upstairs and see what we can find."
It was even worse than before. Lady Smallwood insisted that Arya take another bath and cut and comb her hair besides. The dress she put her in this time was sort of lilac-coloured and decorated with little baby pearls. The only good thing about it was that it was so delicate that no one could expect her to ride in it. So the next morning, as they broke their fast, Lady Smallwood gave her breeches, belt, and tunic to wear, and a brown doeskin jerkin dotted with iron studs.
"They were my son's things," she said. "He, died when he was 7.
"I'm sorry, my lady." Arya suddenly felt bad for her and ashamed. "I'm sorry
I tore the acorn dress, too. It was pretty.
Yes, child. And so are you. Be brave.
Daenerys. In the center of the Plaza of Pride stood a red brick fountain whose water smelled of brimstone, and in the center of the fountain a monstrous harpy made of hammered bronze. 20 feet tall she reared. She had a woman's face with gilded hair, ivory eyes, and pointed ivory teeth. Water gushed yellow from her heavy breasts, but in place of arms she had the wings of a bat or a dragon. Her legs were the legs of an eagle, and behind she wore a scorpion's curled and venomous tail. The Harpy of Gis, Danny thought. Old Gis had fallen 5,000 years ago, if she remembered true, its legions shattered by the might of young Valyria, its brick walls pulled down, its streets and buildings turned to ash and cinder by dragon flame, its very fields sown with salt, sulphur, and skulls. The gods of Gis were dead, and so too its people. These Astapori were Mongols, Ser Jorah said. Even their Giscari tongue was largely forgotten. The slave city spoke the high Valyrian of their conquerors, or what they had made of it. Yet the symbol of the old empire still endured here, though this bronze monster had a heavy chain dangling from her talons, an open manacle at either end. The Harpy of Gis had a thunderbolt in her claws. This is the Harpy of Astapor.
"Tell the Westerosi whore to lower her eyes."
The slaver, Krasnys Monaklas, complained to the slave girl who spoke for him.
"I deal in meat, not metal. The bronze is not for sale. Tell her to look at the soldiers. Even the dim purple eyes of a sunset savage can see how magnificent my creatures are, surely."
Krasny's high Valyrian was twisted and thickened by the characteristic growl of Gis, and flavored here and there with words of slaver Argo. Danny understood him well enough, but she smiled and looked blankly at the slave girl, as if wondering what he might have said.
"The good master Klesnes asks, are they not magnificent?"
The girl spoke the common tongue well, for one who had never been to Westeros. No older than 10, she had the round, flat face, dusky skin, and golden eyes of Naith. The peaceful people, her folk were called, all agreed that they made the best slaves. "They might be adequate to my needs," Danny answered. It had been Ser Jorah's suggestion that she speak only Dothraki and the common tongue while in Astapor. "My bear is more clever than he looks. Tell me of their training."
"The Westerosi woman is pleased with them, but speaks no praise to keep the price down,"
the translator told her master.
"She wishes to know how they are trained."
Krasnys Monaklas bobbed his head. He smelled as if he had been bathed in raspberries, this slaver, and his jutting red-black beard glistened with oil. "He has larger breasts than I do," Danny reflected. She could see them through the thin, sea-green silk of the gold-fringed toka he wound about his body and over one shoulder. His left hand held the toka in place as he walked, while his right clasped a short leather whip.
"Are all Westerosi pigs so ignorant?" he complained. "All the world knows that the Unsullied are masters of spear and shield and short sword."
He gave Danny a broad smile.
"Tell her what she would know, slave, and be quick about it. The day is hot."
That much at least is no lie. A matched pair of slave girls stood behind them, holding a striped silk awning over their heads. But even in the shade Danny felt light-headed, and Krasnys was perspiring freely. The Plaza of Pride had been baking in the sun since dawn. Even through the thickness of her sandals, she could feel the warmth of the red bricks underfoot. Waves of heat rose off them, shimmering, to make the stepped pyramids of Astapor around the plaza seem half a dream. If the unsullied felt the heat, however, they gave no hint of it. They could be made of brick themselves, the way they stand there. 1,000 had been marched out of their barracks for her inspection, drawn up in 10 ranks of 100 before the fountain and its great bronze harpy. They stood stiffly at attention, their stony eyes fixed straight ahead. They wore naught but white linen clouts knotted about their loins, and conical bronze helms topped with a sharpened spike 1 foot tall. Krasnys had commanded them to lay down their spears and shields and doff their sword belts and quilted tunics, so the Queen of Westeros might better inspect the lean hardness of their bodies.
They are chosen young for size and speed and strength, the slave told her. They begin their training at 5. Every day they train from dawn to dusk, until they have mastered the short sword, the shield, and the 3 spears. That training is most rigorous, Your Grace. Only 1 boy in 3 survives it. This is well known. Among the unsullied, it is said that on the day they win the spiked cap, the worst is done with, for no duty that will ever fall to them could be as hard as their training.
Krasis Mornaclus supposedly spoke no word of the common tongue, but he bobbed his head as he listened, and from time to time gave the slave girl a poke with the end of his lash.
"Tell her that these have been standing here for a day and a night with no food nor water. Tell her that they will stand until they drop, if I should command it. And when 999 have collapsed to die upon the bricks, the last will stand there still and never move until his own death claims him. Such is their courage. Tell her that."
"I call that madness, not courage," said Austin Whitebeard, when the solemn little scribe was done.
He tapped the end of his hardwood staff against a brick, tap, tap, as if to tell his displeasure. The old man had not wanted to sail to Astapor, nor did he favor buying the slave army. A queen should hear all sides before reaching a decision. That was why Danny had brought him with her to the Plaza of Pride, not to keep her safe. Her blood riders would do that well enough. Sir Jorah Mormont she had left aboard Beleriand to guard her people and her dragons. Much against her inclination, she had locked the dragons below decks. It was too dangerous to let them fly freely over the city. The world was all too full of men who would gladly kill them for no better reason than to name themselves Dragon Slayer.
"What did the smelly old man say?"
the slaver demanded of his translator. When she told him, he smiled and said,
"Inform the savages that we call this obedience. Others may be stronger or quicker or larger than the unsullied. Some few may even equal their skill with sword and spear and shield, but nowhere between the seas will you ever find any more obedient."
"Sheep are obedient," said Austin, when the words had been translated.
He had some Valerian as well, though not as much as Danny, but like her, he was feigning ignorance. Krasnys Mornaclus showed his big white teeth when that was rendered back to him.
"A word from me, and these sheep would spill his stinking old bowels on the bricks," he said. "But do not say that. Tell them that these creatures are more dogs than sheep. Do they eat dogs or horse in the 7 kingdoms?
They prefer pigs and cows, Your Worship.
Beef, pech, food for unwashed savages."
Ignoring them all, Danny walked slowly down the line of slave soldiers. The girls followed close behind with a silk awning to keep her in the shade, but the 1,000 men before her enjoyed no such protection. More than half of them had the copper skins and almond eyes of Dothraki and Lazarine, but she saw men of the free cities in the ranks as well, along with the pale Carthine, ebon-faced summer islanders, and others whose origins she could not guess. and some had skins of the same amber hue as Krasny's Monatlus, and the bristly red-black hair that marked the ancient folk of Gis who named themselves the Harpy's Sons. They sell even their own kind. It should not have surprised her. The Dothraki did the same, when Khalasar met Khalasar in the Sea of Grass. Some of the soldiers were tall, and some were short. They ranged in age from 14 to 20, she judged. Their cheeks were smooth, and their eyes all the same, be they brown or black or blue or grey or amber. They are like one man, Danny thought, until she remembered they were no men at all. The Unsullied were eunuchs, every one of them. "Why do you cut them?" she asked Krasnys through the slave girl. "Whole men are stronger than eunuchs, I've always heard."
"A eunuch who is cut young will never have the brute strength of one of your Westerosi knights, that is true," said Krasnys Monaclus when the question was put to him. "A bull is strong as well, but bulls die every day in the fighting pits. A girl of 9 killed one not 3 days past in Jothel's pit. The Unsullied have something better than strength, tell her. They have discipline. We fight in the fashion of the old empire, yes. They are the lockstep legions of old Gis come again. Absolutely obedient, absolutely loyal, and utterly without fear."
Danny listened patiently to the translation.
"Even the bravest men fear death and maiming," Austin said when the girl was done.
Krasnys smiled again when he heard that.
"Tell the old man that he smells of piss and needs a stick to hold him up."
"Truly, your worship?"
He poked her with his lash.
"No, not truly. Are you a girl or a goat to ask such folly? Say that Unsullied are not men. Say that death means nothing to them, and maiming less than nothing."
He stopped before a thick-set man who had the look of a Lazar about him, and brought his whip up sharply, laying a line of blood across one copper cheek. The eunuch blinked and stood there bleeding.
"Would you like another?"
asked Krasnys. "If it please your worship." It was hard to pretend not to understand. Danny laid a hand on Krasny's arm before he could raise the whip again. "Tell the good master that I see how strong his Unsullied are and how bravely they suffer pain." Krasnys chuckled when he heard her words in Valyrian.
"Tell this ignorant whore of a Westerner that courage has nothing to do with it."
"The good master says that was not courage, your grace."
"Tell her to open those slapped eyes of hers."
"He begs you to attend this carefully, your grace."
Krasnys moved to the next eunuch in line, a towering youth with the blue eyes and flaxen hair of lice.
"Your sword," he said.
The eunuch knelt, unsheathed the blade, and offered it up hilt first. It was a short sword, made more for stabbing than for slashing, but the edge looked razor sharp.
"Stand!"
Krasnys commanded. "Your worship?" The eunuch stood, and Krasnys Monaclus slid the sword slowly up his torso, leaving a thin red line across his belly and between his ribs. Then he jabbed the sword point in beneath a wide pink nipple and began to work it back and forth. "What's he doing?" Danny demanded of the girl as the blood ran down the man's chest.
"Tell the cow to stop her bleating," said Krasnys,
without waiting for the translation.
"This will do him no great harm. Men have no need of nipples. Eunuchs even less so."
The nipple hung by a thread of skin. He slashed and sent it tumbling to the bricks, leaving behind a round red eye, copiously weeping blood. The eunuch did not move, until Krasnys offered him back his sword, hilt first.
"Here, I've done with you."
"This one is pleased to have served you." Krasnys turned back to Danny.
They feel no pain, you see.
How can that be? She demanded through the scribe.
The wine of courage, was the answer he gave her. It is no true wine at all, but made from deadly nightshade, bloodfly lava, black lotus root, and many secret things. They drink it with every meal from the day they are cut, and with each passing year feel less and less. It makes them fearless in battle, nor can they be tortured. Tell the savage her secrets are safe with the unsullied. She may set them to guard her counsels and even her bedchamber, and never a worry as to what they might overhear. In Yankai and Marine, eunuchs are often made by removing a boy's testicles, but leaving the penis. Such a creature is infertile, yet often still capable of erection. Only trouble can come of this. We remove the penis as well, leaving nothing. The unsullied are the purest creatures on the earth.
He gave Danny and Arstan another of his broad white smiles.
I have heard that in the Sunset Kingdoms men take solemn vows to keep chaste and father no children, but live only for their duty. Is it not so?
It is, Arstan said when the question was put. There are many such orders. The maesters of the Citadel, the septons and scepters who serve the seven, the silent sisters of the dead, the king's guard, and the night's watch.
Poor things, growled the slaver after the translation. Men are not made to live thus. Their days are a torment of temptation. Any fool must see. And no doubt most succumb to their baser selves. Not so are unsullied. They are wed to their swords in a way that your sworn brothers cannot hope to match. No woman can ever tempt them, nor any man.
His girl conveyed the essence of his speech more politely. There are other ways to tempt men besides the flesh, Arstan Whitebeard objected when she was done.
Men, yes, but not unsullied. Plunder interests them no more than rape. They are nothing but their weapons. We do not even permit them names.
No names? Danny frowned at the little scribe. Can that be what the good master said? They have no names?
It is so, your grace.
Krasnys stopped in front of a Geskari, who might have been his taller, fitter brother, and flicked his lash at a small bronze disc on the sword belt at his feet.
There is his name. Ask the whore of Westeros whether she can read Geskari glyphs.
When Danny admitted that she could not, the slaver turned to the unsullied.
What is your name?
He demanded.
This one is called Lord Flea, your worship.
The girl repeated the exchange in the common tongue.
And yesterday, what was it?
Black Lat, your worship.
The day before?
Blonde Flea, your worship.
Before that?
This one does not recall, your worship. Blue Toad, perhaps, or Blue Worm.
Tell her all their names are such, Krasnys commanded the girl. It reminds them that by themselves they are vermin. The name discs are thrown in an empty cask at duty's end, and each dawn plucked up again at random.
More madness, said Arstan, when he heard. How can any man possibly remember a new name every day?
Those who cannot are culled in training, along with those who cannot run all day in full pack, scale a mountain in the black of night, walk across a bed of coals, or slay an infant.
Danny's mouth surely twisted at that. Did he see, or is he blind as well as cruel? She turned away quickly, trying to keep her face a mask until she heard the translation. Only then did she allow herself to say, "Whose infants do they slay?"
To win his spike cap, an unsullied must go to the slave marts with a silver mark. Find some wailing newborn, and kill it before its mother's eyes. In this way, we make certain that there is no weakness left in them.
She was feeling faint. The heat, she tried to tell herself. You take a babe from its mother's arms, kill it as she watches, and pay for her pain with a silver coin? When the translation was made for him, Krasny's Monatlas laughed aloud.
What a soft, mewling fool this one is. Tell the whore of Westeros that the mark is for the child's owner, not the mother. The unsullied are not permitted to steal.
He tapped his whip against his leg.
Tell her that few ever failed that test. The dogs are harder for him, it must be said. We give each boy a puppy on the day that he is cut. At the end of the first year, he is required to strangle it. Any who cannot are killed and fed to the surviving dogs. It makes for a good, strong lesson, we find.
Austin Whitebeard tapped the end of his staff on the bricks as he listened to that. Tap, tap, tap. Slow and steady. Tap, tap, tap. Danny saw him turn his eyes away, as if he could not bear to look at Krasny's any longer. The good master has said that these eunuchs cannot be tempted with coin or flesh, Danny told the girl. But if some enemy of mine should offer them freedom for betraying me,
they would kill him out of hand and bring her his head. Tell her that.
The slaver answered.
Other slaves may steal and hoard up silver in hopes of buying freedom, but an unsullied would not take it if the little mare offered it as a gift. They have no life outside their duty. They are soldiers, and that is all.
It is soldiers I need, Danny admitted.
Tell her it is well she came to Astapor, then. Ask her how large an army she wishes to buy.
How many unsullied you have to sell?
8,000, fully trained and available at present. We sell them only by the unit, she should know. By the 1,000 or the century. Once we sold by the 10, as household guards, but that proved unsound. 10 is too few. They mingle with other slaves, even freemen, and forget who and what they are.
Krasny's waited for that to be rendered in the common tongue, and then continued.
This beggar queen must understand such wonders do not come cheaply. A Yunkai and marine slave swordsman can be had for less than the price of their swords, but unsullied are the finest foot in all the world, and each represents many years of training. Tell her they are like Valyrian steel, folded over and over, and hammered for years on end, until they are stronger and more resilient than any metal on earth.
I know of Valyrian steel, said Danny. Ask the good master if the unsullied have their own officers.
You must set your own officers over them. We train them to obey, not to think. If it is witch she wants, let her buy scribes.
And their gear?
Sword, shield, spear, sandals, and quilted tunic are included, says Krasny's. And the spike caps, to be sure. They will wear such armor as you wish, but you must provide it.
Danny could think of no other questions. She looked at Arstan. You have lived long in the world, Whitebeard. Now that you have seen them, what do you say?
I say no, Your Grace,
the old man answered at once. Why? She asked. Speak freely. Danny thought she knew what he would say, but she wanted the slave girl to hear it, so Krasny's Monatlas might hear later.
My queen, said Arstan. There have been no slaves in the Seven Kingdoms for thousands of years. The old gods and the new alike hold slavery to be an abomination, evil. If you should land in Westeros at the head of a slave army, many good men will oppose you for no other reason than that. You will do great harm to your cause and to the honour of your house.
Yet I must have some army, Danny said. The boy Joffrey will not give me the Iron Throne for asking politely.
When the day comes that you raise your banners, half of Westeros will be with you,
Whitebeard promised.
Your brother Rhaegar is still remembered with great love.
And my father? Danny said. The old man hesitated before saying,
King Aerys is also remembered. He gave the realm many years of peace. Your Grace, you have no need of slaves. Magister Illyrio can keep you safe while your dragons grow, and send secret envoys across the narrow sea on your behalf, to sound out the High Lords for your cause.
Those same High Lords who abandoned my father to the Kingslayer and bent the knee to Robert the Usurper?
Even those who bent their knees may yearn in their hearts for the return of the dragons.
May, said Danny. That was such a slippery word, may, in any language. She turned back to Krasny's Monaclus and his slave girl. I must consider carefully.
The slaver shrugged. Tell her to consider quickly. There are many other buyers. Only 3 days passed. I showed this same unsullied to a Corsair king who hopes to buy them all.
The Corsair wanted only 100, your worship,
Danny heard the slave girl say. He poked her with the end of the whip.
Corsairs are all liars. He'll buy them all. Tell her that, girl.
Danny knew she would take more than 100 if she took any at all. Remind your good master of who I am. Remind him that I am Daenerys Stormborn, mother of dragons, the unburnt, true-born queen of the 7 kingdoms of Westeros. My blood is the blood of Aegon the Conqueror and of old Valyria before him. Yet her words did not move the plump perfume slaver, even when rendered in his own ugly tongue.
All Gis ruled an empire when the Valyrians were still fucking sheep,
he growled at the poor little scribe.
And we are the sons of the Harpy.
He gave a shrug.
My tongue is wasted wagging at women. Tch, east or west, it makes no matter. They cannot decide until they have been pampered and flattered and stuffed with sweetmeats. Well, if this is my fate, so be it. Tell the whore that if she requires a guide to our sweet city, Krasny's Monaclus will gladly serve her, and service her as well, if she is more woman than she looks.
A good Master Krasny's would be most pleased to show you Astapor while you ponder, Your Grace,
the translator said.
I will feed her jellied dog brains and a fine rich stew of red octopus and unborn puppy.
He wiped his lips.
Many delicious dishes can be had here, he says.
Tell her how pretty the pyramids are at night,
the slaver growled.
Tell her I will lick honey off her breasts, or allow her to lick honey off mine, if she prefers.
Astapor is most beautiful at dusk, Your Grace,
said the slave girl.
The good masters light silken lanterns on every terrace, so the pyramids glow with colored lights. Pleasure barges play the worm, playing soft music, and calling at the little islands for food and wine and other delights.
Ask her if she wishes to view our fighting pits,
Krasny's added.
Dukor's pit has a fine folly scheduled for this evening, a bear and 3 small boys. One boy will be rolled in honey, one in blood, and one in rotting fish, and she may wager on which the bear will eat first.
Tap, 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 Danny heard. Aston Whitebeard's face was still, but his staff beat out his rage.
Tap, tap. tap.
She made herself smile. I have my own bear on Balerion, she told the translator, and he may well eat me if I do not return to him.
See, said Krasnus, when her words were translated. It is not the woman who decides. It is this man she runs to, as ever.
Thank the good master for his patient kindness, Danny said, and tell him that I will think on all I learn here. She gave her arm to Arston Whitebeard to lead her back across the plaza to her litter. Aego and Jogo fell in to either side of them, walking with a bow-legged swagger all the horse lords affected when forced to dismount and stride the earth like common mortals. Danny climbed into her litter, frowning, and beckoned Arston to climb in beside her. A man as old as him should not be walking in such heat. She did not close the curtains as they got under way. With the sun beating down so fiercely on this city of red brick, every stray breeze was to be cherished, even if it did come with a swirl of fine red dust. Besides, I need to see. Astapor was a queer city, even to the eyes of one who had walked within the house of dust and bathed in the womb of the world beneath the mother of mountains. All the streets were made of the same red brick that had paved the plaza. So, too, were the stepped pyramids, the deep-dug fighting pits with their rings of descending seats, the sulphurous fountains and gloomy wine caves, and the ancient walls that encircled them. So many bricks, she thought, and so old and crumbling. Their fine red dust was everywhere, dancing down the gutters at every gust of wind. A small wonder that so many Astapori women veiled their faces. The brick dust stung the eyes worse than sand.
"Make way!" Jogo shouted as he rode before her litter. "Make way for the Mother of Dragons!"
But when he uncoiled the great silver-handled whip that Danny had given him and made to crack it in the air, she leaned out and told him, "Nay." "Not in this place, blood of my blood," she said in his own tongue. "These bricks have heard too much of the sound of whips." The streets had been largely deserted when they set out from the port that morning, and scarcely seemed more crowded now. An elephant lumbered past with a latticework litter on its back. A naked boy, with peeling skin, sat in the dry brick gutter, picking his nose and staring sullenly at some ants in the street. He lifted his head at the sound of hooves and gaped as a column of mounted guard trotted by in a cloud of red dust and brittle laughter. The copper discs, sewn to their cloaks of yellow silk, glittered like so many suns, but their tunics were embroidered linen, and below the waist they wore sandals and pleated linen skirts. Bareheaded, each man had teased and oiled and twisted his stiff red-black hair into some fantastic shape. Horns and wings and blades, and even grasping hands, so they looked like some troop of demons escaped from the seventh hell. The naked boy watched them for a bit along with Danny, but soon enough they were gone, and he went back to his ants and a knuckle up his nose. An old city, this, she reflected, but not so populous as it was in its glory, nor near so crowded as Carth or Pentos or Lys. Her litter came to a sudden halt at the cross street to allow a couple of slaves to shuffle across her path, urged along by the crack of an overseer's lash. These were no unsullied, Danny noted, but a more common sort of men, with pale brown skins and black hair. There were women among them, but no children. All were naked. Two Astapori rode behind them on white asses. A man in a red silk toga and a veiled woman in sheer blue linen, decorated with flakes of lapis lazuli. In her red-black hair, she wore an ivory comb. The man laughed as he whispered to her, paying no more mind to Danny than to his slaves, nor the overseer with his twisted, five-thonged lash. A squat, broad Dothraki who had the harpy and chains tattooed proudly across his muscular chest. "Bricks and blood," built Astapor,
Whitebread murmured at her side. In bricks and blood, her people.
What is that? Danny asked him, curious.
An old rhyme a maester taught me when I was a boy. I never knew how true it was. The bricks of Astapor are red with blood of the slaves who make them.
Well, I can well believe that, said Danny.
Then leave this place before your heart turns to brick as well. Sail this very night on the evening tide.
Would that I could, thought Danny. When I leave Astapor, it must be with an army, Sir Jorah says.
Sir Jorah was a slaver himself, your grace, the old man reminded her. There are sellswords in Pentos and Myrrh and Tyrus you can hire. A man who kills a coin has no honour, but at least they are no slaves. Find your army there, I beg you.
My brother visited Pentos, Myrrh, Bravos, near all the free cities. The magisters and archons fed him wine and promises, but his soul was starved to death. A man cannot sup from the beggar's bowl all his life and stay a man. I had my taste in Karth. That was enough. I will not come to Pentos, bowl in hand.
Better to come a beggar than a slaver, Arston said.
There speaks one who has been neither. Danny's nostrils flared. Do you know what it's like to be sold, squire?
I do.
My brother sold me to Khal Drogo for the promise of a golden crown. Well, Drogo crowned him in gold, though not as he had wished, and I... My sun and stars made a queen of me. But if he had been a different man, it might have been much otherwise. Do you think I have forgotten how it felt to be afraid? Whitebeard bowed his head.
Your grace, I did not mean to give offence.
Only lies offend me, and never honest counsel. Danny patted Arston's spotted hand to reassure him. I have a dragon's temper, that's all. You must not let it frighten you.
I shall try and remember, Whitebeard smiled.
He has a good face and great strength to him, Danny thought. She could not understand why Sir Jorah mistrusted the old man so. Could he be jealous that I have found another man to talk to? Unbidden, her thoughts went back to the night on Beleriand when the exile knight had kissed her. He should never have done that. He is thrice my age, and too low a birth for me. And I never gave him leave. No true knight would ever kiss a queen without her leave. She had taken care never to be alone with Sir Jorah after that, keeping her handmaids with her aboard ship, and sometimes her blood riders. He wants to kiss me again. I see it in his eyes. What Danny wanted she could not begin to say, but Jorah's kiss had woken something in her, something that had been sleeping since Khal Drogo died. Lying abed in her narrow bunk, she found herself wondering how it would be to have a man squeezed in beside her in place of her handmaid, and the thought was more exciting than it should have been. Sometimes she would close her eyes and dream of him, but it was never Jorah Mormont she dreamed of. Her lover was always younger and more comely, though his face remained a shifting shadow. Once, so tormented she could not sleep, Danny slid a hand down between her legs and gasped when she felt how wet she was. Scarce daring to breathe, she moved her fingers back and forth between her lower lips, slowly so as not to wake Eerie beside her, until she found one sweet spot and lingered there, touching herself lightly, timidly at first, and then faster. Still, the relief she wanted seemed to recede before her, until her dragon stirred, and one screamed out across the cabin, and Eerie woke and saw what she was doing. Danny knew her face was flushed, but in the darkness Eerie surely could not tell. Wordless, the handmaid put a hand on her breast, then bent to take a nipple in her mouth. The other hand drifted down across the soft curve of belly, through the mound of fine silvery gold hair, and went to work between Danny's thighs. It was no more than a few moments until her legs twisted and her breast heaved and her whole body shuddered. She screamed then. Or perhaps that was Drogon. Eerie never said a thing, only curled back up and went back to sleep.
the instant the thing was done. The next day, it all seemed a dream. And what did Sir Jorah have to do with it, if anything? "It is Drogo I want, my sun and stars," Danny reminded herself. "Not Iri, not Sir Jorah, only Drogo." Drogo was dead, though. She thought those feelings had died with him, there in the red waste. But one treacherous kiss had somehow brought them back to life. "He should never have kissed me. He presumed too much, and I permitted it. It must never happen again." She set her mouth grimly and gave her head a shake, and the bell in her braid chimed softly. Closer to the bay, the city presented a fairer face. The great brick pyramids lined the shore, the largest 400 feet high. All manner of trees and vines and flowers grew on their broad terraces, and the winds that swirled around them smelled green and fragrant. Another gigantic harpy stood atop the gate, this one made of baked red clay and crumbling visibly, with no more than a stub of her scorpion's tail remaining. The chain she grasped in her clay claws was old iron, rotten with rust. It was cooler down by the water, though. The lapping of the waves against the rotting pilings made a curiously soothing sound. Ego helped Danny down from her litter. Strong Belwas was seated on a massive piling, eating a great haunch of brown roasted meat. "Dog," he said happily when he saw Danny. "Good dog, Inastabor, little queen. Eat!" He offered it with a greasy grin. "That is kind of you, Belwas, but no." Danny had eaten dog in other places at other times, but just now all she could think of was the Unsullied and their stupid puppies. She swept past the huge eunuch and up the plank onto the deck of Balerion. Sir Jorah Mormont stood waiting for her. "Your Grace," he said, bowing his head, "the slavers have come and gone. 3 of them, with 12 scribes, and as many slaves to lift and fetch. They crawled over every foot of our holds and made note of all we had." He walked her aft. "How many men do they have for sale?" "None." Was it Mormont she was angry with, or this city with its sullen heat, its stinks and sweats and crumbling bricks? "They sell eunuchs, not men. Eunuchs made of brick, like the rest of Astapor. Shall I buy 8,000 brick eunuchs with dead eyes that never move, who kill suckling babes for the sake of a spiked hat and strangle their own dogs? They don't even have names, so don't call them men, sir."
"Khaleesi," he said, taken aback by her fury, "the Unsullied are chosen as boys and trained."
"I have heard all that I care to hear of their training." Danny could feel tears welling in her eyes, sudden and unwanted. A hand flashed up and cracked Sir Jorah hard across the face. It was either that or cry. Mormont touched the cheek she'd slapped.
"If I have displeased my queen..."
"You have. You've displeased me greatly, sir. If you were my true knight, you would never have brought me to this vile sty."
"If you were my true knight, you would never have kissed me, or looked at my breast the way you did, or—" "As your Grace commands, I shall tell Captain Grolio to make ready to sail on the evening tide for some sty less vile."
"No," said Danny. Grolio watched them from the forecastle, and his crew was watching too. Whitebeard, her blood riders, Jiqui, everyone had stopped what they were doing at the sound of the slap. "I want to sail now. Not on the tide. I want to sail far and fast and never look back. But I can't, can I? There are 8,000 brick eunuchs for sale, and I must find some way to buy them." And with that she left him and went below. Behind the carved wooden door of the captain's cabin, her dragons were restless. Drogon raised his head and screamed, pale smoke venting from his nostrils. And Viserion flapped at her and tried to perch on her shoulder, as he had when he was smaller. "No," Danny said, trying to shrug him off gently. "You're too big for that now, sweetling." But the dragon coiled his white and gold tail around one arm and dug black claws into the fabric of her sleeve, clinging tightly. Helpless, she sank into Grolio's great leather chair, giggling. She showed Danny the marks of his teeth on her hand. Did any of them try to burn their way free? That was the thing that frightened Danny the most.
No, Khaleesi. Drogon breathed his fire, but in the empty air, the slaver men feared to come near him.
She kissed Iri's hand where Drogon had bitten it. I'm sorry he hurt you. Dragons are not meant to be locked up in a small ship's cabin.
Dragons are like horses in this, Iri said, and riders, too. The horses scream below, Khaleesi, and kick at the wooden walls. I hear them. And Jiqui says the old women and the little ones scream, too, when you are not here. They do not like this water cart. They do not like the black salt sea.
I know, Danny said. I do, I know.
My Khaleesi is sad?
Yes, Danny admitted. Sad and lost.
Should I pleasure the Khaleesi?
Danny stepped away from her. No, Iri, you do not need to do that. What happened that night when you woke? You're no bed slave. I freed you. Remember?
I am handmaid to the Mother of Dragons, the girl said. It is great honor to please my Khaleesi.
I don't want that, she insisted. I don't. She turned away sharply. Leave me now. I want to be alone, to think. Dusk had begun to settle over the waters of Slaver's Bay before Danny returned to the deck. She stood by the rail and looked out over Astapor.
From here it looks almost beautiful, she thought.
The stars were coming out above and the silk lanterns below, just as Krasny's translator had promised. The brick pyramids were all glimmery with light. But it is dark below, in the streets and plazas and fighting pits, and it is the darkest of all in the barracks, where some little boy is feeding scraps to the puppy they gave him when they took away his manhood. There was a soft step behind her.
Khaleesi!
His voice.
Might I speak frankly?
Danny did not turn. She could not bear to look at him just now. If she did, she might well slap him again, or cry, or kiss him, and never know which was right, and which was wrong, and which was madness. Say what you will, sir.
When Aegon the Dragon stepped ashore in Westeros, the kings of Vale and Rock and Reach did not rush to hand him their crowns. If you mean to sit his iron throne, you must win it as he did, with steel and dragon fire. And that will mean blood on your hands before the thing is done.
Blood and fire, thought Danny. The words of House Targaryen. She had known them all her life. The blood of my enemies I will shed gladly. The blood of innocents is another matter. 8,000 unsullied they would offer me. 8,000 dead babies, 8,000 strangled dogs.
Your Grace, said Jorah Mormont, I saw King's Landing after the sack. Babes were butchered that day as well, and old men and children at play. More women were raped than you can count. There's a savage beast in every man, and when you hand that man a sword or spear and send him forth to war, the beast stirs. The scent of blood is all it takes to wake him. Yet I've never heard of these unsullied raping, nor putting a city to the sword, nor even plundering, save at the express command of those who led them. Bricks they may be, as you say, but if you buy them henceforth, the only dogs they'll kill are those you want dead. And you do have some dogs you want dead, as I recall.
The usurper's dogs.
Yes. Danny gazed off at the soft-coloured lights and let the cool salt breeze caress her. You speak of sacking cities. Answer me this, sir.
Why have the Dothraki never sacked this city? She pointed. Look at the walls. You can see where they've begun to crumble. There and there. Do you see any guards?